This episode is brought to you by Major Spoilers VIP members. Thank you for your support of Major Spoilers and the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you would like to become a bronze, silver, or gold VIP member, go to members.majorspoilers.com for more information.
Welcome to Critical Hit, a Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading. This week, it is mailbag. It has been far too long, man. Mm-hmm. It's been like...
well, 11 years.
It seems like 11 years since we've done a mailbag. This will be a little bit longer. We're not going to get through all of the questions that have been sent in, because a lot of times your questions may be very similar, or they are something that's been answered over the course of the gameplay in other sessions, situations. So, there you go with that. So the first question comes from Alan, who says, "Longtime listener, first-time emailer. I've been loving the show, and I'm working my way through the podcast, currently up to 104. I have a question for you. As a game mechanic, I hear you regularly perform checks, for example, a nature or arcana check, while investigating a situation. I understand how it works practically. Depending on how the high roll is, you release a certain level of information, meaning that a very low roll could result in either information being hidden from the party or, in a worst case, misinformation being given. My question is whether there is a way to get around the fourth wall aspect, in other words, the party knowing that they have rolled low or high, and therefore how much attention to pay to the information that's given."
There is a lot of situations the game calls for you to make secret checks. So where the game master is the one that rolls for players.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can sometimes make these checks ahead of time and say, like, well, so everybody's going to be ambushed, you know, halfway through the game, so I'll just make these rolls. I look at everybody's sheet, make the rolls ahead of time, see who's going to be flat-footed and who isn't, and that sort of thing. The opposite way of getting around it is that you're just constantly making everybody always make checks for everything.
Right.
And then... the fact that something might come up or be problematic, they're not necessarily aware of it, but they will know if they got a low roll.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to put your faith on the player's role-playing, the fact that their character doesn't know it.
True.
But that does put pressure on the players then to role-play something that they don't know, and it kind of has to be optional. Like, we've had plenty of times when, for example, Orin will roll low on something, and because of the character, because of who he is, it's a lot of fun to hear him talk about something the wrong way and be oblivious because he thinks he's so smart.
Right.
Whereas in some senses, like, Ket just not getting an arcana check comes across as almost the same way as him nailing the arcana check, which is he just kind of doesn't share the information with the rest of the party unless he feels it's necessary.
Yeah.
So you can lean on role playing for that as well. But I think for the purposes of this question, secret checks are good, but then you have to ask yourself, how frequently do I do this? Yeah. And if you only do secret checks when the information's important, then anytime you do a secret check, your characters are going to know that, or your players are going to know something's up. And they're going to act weird because of it.
Yeah.
I mean, what you can do a lot of time is just basically let them know in character that their characters know that they did miss something.
Right.
And, you know,
there's something not quite right here, but you don't know what it is.
Or you just some piece of information that has eluded your grasp, and you have to go find other means to try to get a hold of it.
Right. And a big part of that is that, you know, given lots of time and lots of resources, then maybe the character will figure it out anyway. And in that situation, you might not even require a roll, right? If Orim is in his lab and he's trying to figure out some compound, and I'm like, well, Steven, how long are you going to work on it? And he's like, well, we don't have to leave until next week, so I work on it for a week. And I'm like, well, by the end of the week, here's basically all the information. Figure it out. But if you are something like, there's a pack of gnolls that are about to fall on you and you need to make a check, you make one check. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't work, then there's other stuff that you need to deal with.
Yeah, there's also the part of the question where providing misinformation on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's usually not going to be the case. Like, we're providing the players with misinformation, and especially if you're rolling and they know they have a low roll, the hidden information is better than the misinformation.
Right, because then they'll feel... Yeah, sometimes players will get this thing where it's like, I know that this is wrong, but now I have to roleplay it this way. And you don't necessarily want to do that. It depending on your group and depending on the player, that can be a lot of fun. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily want to put that on every
player.
You
can also give them a mix of good and bad information. And
right.
They don't know which is which.
Exactly. And, yeah, you can definitely try to just be tricky about it and say, it's like, well, it's definitely this big and made of bees, and they know that one of those two things is wrong.
Made of bees is always correct.
Mark from Florida writes in, I've been listening to your show. I've listened to each episode maybe 6 times. Question, I know it was stated that Randus has an outside source for his familiar, a disembodied hand that is now a crab robo thing. However, I couldn't find the familiar feat. I was planning on grabbing this feat at 4th or 6th level, and I'm level 1 now. Well, at the time of this writing. I'm fully prepared for this answer to come in April.
Hey! Hey!
Good on you!
So what's the deal?
The familiar feat itself was in...
Complete Arcane, I believe.
Arcane Power, that's what it is.
So that's where it comes from.
Called this generation?
We'll worry about that later.
From the Arcane Power book?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So it's there. The disembodied hand, I believe, was a web thing.
It was from Dragon Magazine online.
Yeah. And you allowed that?
I specifically allow things from the internet if I get a chance to check them. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just
to make sure they're balanced and not...
Yep. Broken. Actually, I think walking into, or like the majority of the game, Randus was actually packing a lot of weird, or at least the most features from Dragon Magazine than anybody else. Yeah, but anyway,
the nature of the artificer.
Artificers have two sources.
Yep. So there's that. But if you're, for example, looking at it on the builder, only arcane characters can have familiars. So if you're playing a fighter and you don't see the feet pop up, that's why. If you're playing a sword mage, yeah. And yes, so you can either play an arcane class or multi-class into any arcane class, and then you'll have access to familiars.
Yeah. You can find something that'll probably work for you.
Yep.
There's a good range.
Yep.
Okay. What is the difference between difficult terrain and hindering terrain? Thanks, Joshua.
That is a good question. Let me get my computer out.
Yes, because one of them is... terrain that it makes your movement hindered. That's probably hindering terrain.
Half movement or something.
Half movement on terrain. The other one is something that is some other source of obstacles, such as these squares cause damage when you enter them, or some other bad thing when you enter those space.
Yeah. I think difficult terrain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
I want to say one of them is like an umbrella term, which encompasses both. Maybe.
That's not confusing at all.
Yeah.
Everyone's looking.
Yep. Let's see. The best thing about the 4th edition compendium is that no matter what you type in, the first thing it guesses you want is definitely not what you want. If I type hindering terrain, does it take me to the glossary? No. The first thing is like, oh, you want feats that deal with hindering terrain.
Yes. Difficult terrain costs 1 extra square.
Okay.
Hindering terrain is pits, electrified runes, lava, extremely deep water, and other harmful environmental phenomena.
Meaning you can't pass them at all. Right. Or you can't get through it at all without...
Or there's some cost for moving into them beyond the movement penalty, which oftentimes hindering terrain is difficult.
Yes, that's right. So that's kind of a thing there. You do get a saving throw before you are thrown into a pit of lava or whatever, which I think we've been basically
doing
for difficult terrain as well, which isn't a big deal if everybody gets the saving throw.
Yeah.
So yes, that's the difference.
Would you consider your next off season doing a horrid GM game where whoever the GM is does everything wrong? Sometimes seeing the wrong can help avoid it. Plus, it would be funny railroading, flat wrong story for characters or players, etc.
No,
I don't think so.
No, I don't.
I don't. We're never
from a storytelling perspective. That's not from the entertainment perspective. That doesn't sound interesting.
Yeah, I don't. I don't think we at Critical Hit are ever going to purposefully play a game that isn't fun.
Yeah,
it might not turn out fun. Because you never know.
Yeah.
But it's us, so it'll turn out at least a little bit fun.
we hope.
Yeah. So no, I think we want to try to show the system as best as we can show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In regards to your Amazon link, does that work if I click it, select a new set of dice, then research a printer for a while, hopping between different products before finding the one I want? No, that's whatever you buy through that link, doesn't matter how many times you're bouncing around the Amazon page, whatever you add into that cart gets attributed to us, and we get a percentage of those sales back.
What I try to do, and I think this works, is a lot of the time I'll go into Amazon, I'll look up whatever I want. If I need to close it or whatever, I'll just put stuff in my cart. And then afterwards, I'll go to Major Spoilers, click on the link, and then just access my cart full of the stuff that I've already gotten. And that's pretty much a guaranteed way that if you closed out of the window and then open it again or whatever, or like that's a lot more likely that, that everything
But if you're just staying
counts.
Around in the same page on Amazon and flipping around inside Amazon, not opening other pages, et cetera, then yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, I do that, especially since I get paranoid on Amazon. It's like, did I go through Major Spoilers? I don't even remember. Let's just close, go back through, go into
my cart. Put stuff in your cart, close out, go to Major Spoilers, go through the link, and then pay for everything.
And I know it's a question that comes up a lot because I get a tweet about it every once in a while. Hey, has Amazon changed their policy about those of us in Canada and Mexico and Germany and Australia? No, they haven't. They really have changed that to only make it country specific now. And so we love all of our international fans, and unfortunately using that Amazon link doesn't help us at all, and doesn't really help you at all unless you're paying shipping from the United States to your country, which I wouldn't advise.
Yeah,
just because it gets too expensive. I would like to pose a question in the group for a future mailbag. Oh, okay, well, we'll just wait for a future
mailbag. Oh, no, poor guy.
My boy has been into the world of Last Airbender since the first time around. Say we were to try to work a game around that setting, would D&D work well where you were just flavoring things as I airbend these three gusts and they happen to do damage like a magic missile? Yeah. Or a game system like Savage Worlds more adaptable for that kind of playthrough?
I think either.
Either.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah. I know I've played... At least it's offer a little bit a system where someone did a homebrew version of 4th edition with the avatar classes. But was it the game I ran at Nerdtacular a couple years ago? I had a character that was essentially supposed to be the avatar.
Yep. I would recommend Fate. You have now listened to us play an entire Fate campaign. Fate is... precisely what I would suggest by that. Like, if you love Avatar, if you love Steven Universe, if you love Danny Phantom, if you love all of that stuff, Fate is going to be uniquely made for that, because it's a game that skews towards action, but also is loose enough that you can basically fit anything in it. And it's going to be a game where you basically guarantee that your Kataras are just as powerful as your Sokkas, and vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. And you could always do a Hannah Montana in the Fate system, and you attack with a wrecking ball.
I mean, you could. That's the thing. So. Like, that's the thing is, we still played a pretty combat heavy game, but Fate does allow you to play very not combat heavy.
True story type session stuff. Sure. Yeah. No, that's cool.
I would say that the Savage Worlds, most recent rulebook at least, does have like a skin that you can put on each of the arcane powers to flavor them a particular element. So it would be pretty easy to mechanically, just to say, make a particular elemental guy.
Love the podcast, says Chad. Now to my question. The PHB seems to separate the definition of critical hit and automatic hit. A nat 20, for example, automatically hits and deals a critical hit. This would indicate that the automatic hit is not actually part of the critical hit definition, but rather a separate effect. The reason I ask this is that as you gain levels, there are scenarios where you can crit on an 18 or 19. Does this then mean that the 18 and 19 critical hits do deal damage per the definition, but do not auto-hit, and therefore would still need to be fully calculated to ensure the attack hits the required defense?
No, it's the other way around. When you... roll a nat 20, or in this case an 18 or a 19 or 18 as per the power or weapon or whatever you're using, you get that automatic hit. Then you compare that roll to their armor class or whatever you're hitting, and if it still hits, then it's double damage. Mm-hmm. Or, I'm sorry, it's full damage.
Max damage.
Max damage.
Plus whatever extra crit damage.
Sure, mm-hmm. Plus crit dice or whatever. And the reason for that is so that little baby adventurers can't go up against Orcus and crit them, because they're, even if you roll a 20, you're still not going to be able to crack his AC, so you just get that automatic hit and not get the extra dice.
You previously talked about how Rodrigo created the gods of the setting by taking the parts of the D&D gods that he liked. Do you have any tips for making gods without basing them on any RPG books? I'm working on a setting of my own and want to bring something new to the table and give my players something that they don't expect. That seems rather easy, right? I mean, pick a name. Pick what that god represents. The god of peace and love and joy.
Yeah. Jeff, the god of biscuits.
You know, Susan, the goddess of the harvest. You know, those are things, I mean, it seems relatively easy to pick those out unless you have to pick, unless he's talking about some other things like interacting with those gods and what they add to your character.
Actually, it might be more complex than you think.
Specifically with something like Dungeons & Dragons that has actual mechanical definitions to what gods provide. Look at the, what are they called in this one?
Domains?
That's the one. Look at the domains. See, you know, you have an idea for a god, like Susan, the god of love and harvest.
Actually, just the harvest.
Susan, the god of the harvest.
It's Jeff, the god of love and peace.
Okay. but you've got Susan, the god of the harvest. Take a look at what the domains are. See what domains you think would fit under Susan. And put those in there and build a personality around the idea of someone who is always taking care of the harvest and providing what domains you determined were appropriate. The other thing is, you probably want to make sure all the domains are covered, just in case one of your players decides, I want to be a cleric and take this domain. That way they have the ability to choose such and such domain. That's why the Stegosaurus in my campaign ended up with poison and madness and something else that was just really weird.
They have very small brains and bad immune systems, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Thematically speaking, there's lots of ways to go about it. You can look at, I mean, your gods can represent any number of things. They can represent big, important things in your setting. They can represent cultural issues, just like the gods of real world religions do, is like, what does this god mean to these people? And that sort of thing. You can take your gods and put them along an axis, right? It's like, what's important in the world? The important thing in this world is balance. As long as the gods are balanced, everything's fine, right? So then you can have like instead of having a god of light and a god of darkness, you can have a god of light and darkness. Mm-hmm. Apollo, for example, aside from being a sun god, was also the god of medicine and also a god of disease, because that's the two sides of that aspect, right? You can decide what it's like to be a god and then base it on that. You know, is your heaven where the gods live a horrendously convoluted bureaucracy? Or is it just like five guys in awesome thrones throwing lightning bolts at people? Like, either one of those works, but thematically, that's actually going to potentially trickle down into your world. And you can do it in either direction, right? You can also say, what do I want religious organizations to be like in my world? I want them to be basically big paramilitary organizations, which is what they are in Critical Hit. And it's like, well, then it makes sense for there to be five guys who got together and made their little god cartel and five other guys who don't like those guys and made their own, and basically just empower people to actually just shoot lightning bolts at each other.
Mm-hmm.
You can basically take any of those lines and you can end up with a drastically different pantheon and a drastically different dynamic between gods and their people and the gods as, you know, each other.
Chris in Orlando writes, my friend just invited me to role play a heavy Pathfinder game, and my gears in my head are starting to turn. I know that he plans on rolling from a table to give our characters unique drawbacks. I'm working through the interpersonal issues of this get out now scenario, but I was curious, have you ever been in a game where the GM imposed roleplay aspects on your character outside of your control? Feels like this is a kind of system has its limits, but otherwise serves only to torpedo a well-rounded character design.
Well, all of these guys have played them because I've literally just handed you guys characters.
Those are pre-constructed characters, which is different than creating a character and then having
the
drawback put onto it.
The only way I've done this where I created a character that was given a drawback was some of the third edition books had like random character traits and drawbacks, and we rolled up a couple of positives and a couple negatives first, and then built the character from there.
Right. Yeah.
Which, if your DM's cool with that, that's easier.
I would say if you haven't, like, if you made a character and then your game master was like, oh, we're going to do this, then, like, gut out the role playing core of the character and just keep the mechanics. If you're like, oh, I'm a fighter who was a city watch person and he loves kids, but he had to leave because a dragon blew up his town, just take that out. Just get rid of it. You're like a collection of feats and stats. And then when you're handed your drawbacks, build the character and backstory around that.
Have you ever run into anything like this, Matthew?
Oh, yeah. I think to some degree, Rodrigo has done it to us, even with the primary characters. But it's what it sounds like, and the way that it's being presented makes it sound like kind of a not necessarily a control move by the Dungeon Master, but a move to try and add something that he wants into the characters and into the game. I think if it's something that's a real problem for you, if you're really worried about it, bring it to his attention and say, you know, I'm a little concerned about how this is going to work with what I wanted to do, and I want to get together with you and see, you know, make sure how we can play the game that you want to play, that I can play the character that I want to be in that world, to where, you know, if, for instance, you want to be a really cool running guy and he wants to give you a wooden leg, obviously there's got to be some sort of middle ground.
Yeah, there's nothing actually...
Oh, go ahead. If you have a wooden leg, then, you know, you also, you know, what you're dealing with in the game.
Yeah, there's nothing actually fundamentally wrong about that. You just have to be, as a game master, you just have to be careful about how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, basically you pitch it to the to the players as, so here's this game, don't come up with your character concept yet. I'm going to do this thing where we're going to roll and give you guys these traits and then make your character around that kind of thing. And that's not a crazy thing to do. There are systems where that's a lot easier to do than Dungeons and Dragons. But I actually haven't played Pathfinder, so I wouldn't know how easy it is to incorporate.
Yeah, I don't know. If this is basically something, I mean, if you are basically growing up this big, strong fighter and you come into the session and he's like, okay, well, you got weakened immunity system where now you get, you know, how many ever less hit points every thing.
Well, that's RP aspects was role-playing.
Did they say role-playing? Okay, that's better. Yeah. That's,
So yeah, just
if it was that, I would just say get out. But
And even then, it's like you gotta hope that there's some kind of like veto system, because it's like your character is afraid of swords or something like that. It's like, well,
it's gonna be a fighter.
Well, forget that. It's like, well, I can't be a wizard either, because someone's gonna come at me with a sword eventually.
Matthew, what were you gonna say?
I think you have to look at it. If this is something that is immutable and something you can deal with, you have to look at it as a collaborative experience.
Yeah.
The DM is collaborating with you on creating this character who's going to have their role play aspects that he wants you to deal with. And he may be doing it because he wants the game to be more interesting from a role play perspective, and he believes that you can handle it. And he knows that if you're the Flash with a wooden leg, you'll pull this off. If it is a really huge deal breaker, again, bring it to his attention and say, I'm concerned. Don't, you know, crack at him, because Rodrigo will hit you over the head if you say, I don't want to do that.
Oh, speaking of hitting someone over the head, Matt writes in, I had a homebrew setting that was totally 100% my own, and while I thought I made it clear, I had one player who at every turn was telling me his character was like blah, 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 because this event happened in one of the real D&D realms. It eventually took me metaphorically beating him over the head with a brick until he understood I made this whole thing up and that it's its own realm, not connected to the rest of the D&D universe. Have any of the Critical Hit crew had an issue with a player for not understanding your setting or that your setting was homebrewed?
No. Usually that goes away pretty quickly.
Yeah.
That's a tough one to deal with. I mean, because basically you've got a player who isn't willing to buy into the compact of the game. You know, like we said previously when talking about Fate, I trust you guys to play Fate, to rein yourselves in and to keep me reined in. But if you have something like that, I think it's more than just a question of this is my setting and set it up. This is a question of he's not kind of holding up his end of the bargain in the whole Dungeon Master gameplay thing.
Right. Now, just to not completely kick this player too hard, you know, a kick is probably called for, but not too hard. There are players who derive a great deal of their satisfaction about role-playing games by knowing things about the world of the role-playing game. Mm-hmm. So basically, we talked a few weeks ago or a week ago in the Fate system about Rob's kind of at least mild dissatisfaction with the lack of a tactical aspect to Fate.
Right.
That tactical aspect is actually what Rob likes about role-playing games, and he can step out of it, but the game experience is lessened for him. Just like that, there are going to be players who walk in and say, like, I know everything that has ever happened in Eberron. Mm-hmm. We're not playing Eberron. But can we? You know, like, I was...
Well, but, I mean, you're right. There are people that pride themselves on sports statistics and people that pride themselves on knowing everything about...
into the settings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are people and, like, for example, me and probably and actually Matthew, like, where if you sat us down and said, is like, this is exactly how things go, there is like no room. Like, I played a Game of Thrones game once, before Game of Thrones like got popular. Like, this kid walked in and is like, do you guys read Game of Thrones? No, we're gonna play this game, and just put the giant hardback on the table, and it's huge, And he's like, okay, so what house do you want to be in? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe this one. Can I do this? And they're like, no, those guys wouldn't do that. And he's like, oh, well, can I do this other thing? And I ended up kind of making a character, but the bounds were really tight.
Right.
Also, that system is awful. But anyway, that's besides the point.
I believe this was the old system that Green Ronin did. They got a new one now.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. But yeah, I was like constantly chafing against the system because and against the themes of the game. A, because I'd never read Game of Thrones and the show wasn't out yet. And B, because the game master wanted to keep us within the house and within what the people of that house would be like.
Right.
So I'd be like, well, I do this. It's like, no, will the Stark really do that? And I'm like,
I don't
if sure. I do that, I if know. I do it while wearing a direwolf pelt, am I allowed to do it?
Yeah, one of the things with this player, with him wanting to know, or coming in knowing everything about the specific setting, one, you may double check to make sure that nothing that you did in your homebrew is too similar to the setting, like, you know, double check city names and whatnot, just... Yeah.
Well, I think it's hard. I mean, it can be very hard, and I know that, you know, there's Dark Sun and Eberron and Forgotten Realms and all this stuff. But I think it can be hard when you say, okay, this is 100% homebrewed. Now you're a dwarf wizard, and here are all the dwarf wizard powers from the campaign books and the player's guides, and suddenly you're like, well, all Dungeons and Dragons is the same, and maybe that's where he's coming from, is just this mindset of well, this is what the player's handbook says, and if I'm a dwarf, I come from this land and I do these things,
right?
And that could be part of the problem too, but not to.
That is a hard thing to cope with when you are coming into a new setting that's homebrewed, and it's like, okay, so how much of this do we carry over from the old, or how much is new?
And how do you explain, like, dragon marks, right? Dragon marks are a huge part of Eberron. If somebody walks in dragon mark, it's like you have to write a whole new story for dragon marks.
And the other thing I was going to say was, if that player is just that much excited about having that much lore for a system, give him some. Like,
give him
lore for your campaign. Yep. If he wants to know the history of what's going on, tell him the history of what's going on. Like,
perhaps
tell him,
start making a blog, put it all up, and give him the link. And
if he said his character is from this long lineage of hunters or something, you know, possibly figure out why a long lineage of hunters would be in your setting and let him have it.
Yep. And let him make
and,
stuff up.
And
yep.
Tell him that encourages some collaborative roleplay.
Tell him that you've got veto power and tell him to, you know, it's like, well, if you want to know lots of stuff about things, mm-hmm. start making them, just start throwing stuff at me. It's like, maybe the sun is full of fire elementals. Great. Sure. That's great. Maybe the moon is also full of fire elementals. Nope, no. I don't like that. Come up with something else, or I'll come up with something for the moon.
Cheese elementals.
Meese elementals.
I like chocolate milk.
Thomas writes in and says that he really enjoys, his favorite character is a cleric mind flayer necromancer. He's just wondering if you guys have ever had anyone play a mind flayer in any campaign that you guys have been in or ran.
Have I ever had a player play? I think I have.
Are those the psionic ones?
Yeah, they're the guy. Yeah. They're the mini Cthulhu looking dudes.
Yeah,
the Illithid guys. Yeah, I had a guy play one. In a game that I ran, actually. And I don't believe that there were, at the time, any type of stats for it. Mm. So basically what we did was, this was during the day when there was a little brown handbook for psionics.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically ran the character as a psionic, but his flavor text, his coloring, his hat, whatever you want to call it, was that he was a mind flayer, but mechanically... he was just some schmuck running around using the psionic powers from the psionic handbook the way we wrote it.
Right.
Or the way they wrote it, I guess.
And that would be the way to do it, because the last time I saw a playable Illithid, it was in 3rd edition, and it was super wonky.
Yeah, the stat bumps for Illithids were massive.
Yeah, and just like a big... In 3rd edition, you had this thing where like you could play a much more powerful creature race mm-hmm. at the expense of... being lower in class level.
Oh, okay.
So if your standard elf ranger was at level 10 and you were walking with an Illithid, you were probably actually at like level 2 or something
like
that.
Level 2 or 3, yeah. And larger level monsters also came with essentially monster levels to start with.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So you would have to, basically, before you could actually take a level in any given class, you would be level 10, 12, 15 equivalent. You know, all your friends are a level 15 elf ranger, human wizard, blah, blah, blah. You're just now becoming a level 1 mind flayer cleric.
Right.
That was largely a later addition that the monster levels.
Yeah. That was a 3-5 thing, and from one particular book, and not a lot of people liked it because you don't get hit dice every level. It's weird. It's like weird. Super weird. So, yes, I would say if you're out there and you really, really want to play a mind flayer and your dungeon master will let you, find a race that kind of does what you want and then just flavor it as like
slap
maybe
some tentacles on
it. Maybe once you kill something, then you can eat its brain as opposed to like what they had in 3rd edition, which is like if they get a good grapple on you, that's it for your brain. Save against brain.
Aled or Aled from Wales. Aled. He's a silver VIP, loves the podcast. I've played 4E for 3 years now and have run the occasional one-shot or small series of games. However, they've all been published adventures, and my players love it, as I almost always allow them to progress as they want to. As such, I feel confident in my ability to improvise and allow the story to progress. However, what I do have a problem with is the nitty-gritty of pre-planning for campaigns, and that I come up with an idea regarding a story for a new campaign, such as there's an artifact that spreads life force throughout the world. It's been corrupted and taken by a lich. Your players must stop this, but I'm not sure how to pace the story, how to fill in the middle parts. What does everyone suggest or advise? Matthew?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Hit me with it again.
Well, I think he's essentially saying, how do I basically take almost a canned adventure and let them play in that world?
He's had experience playing these kind of adventures and has a lot of fun and success with them.
He's asking how does he do his own adventure for the first time.
Basically, he's got the idea for the campaign that he wants to run, but he doesn't know how to pace it, which NPCs to have in the middle, so that, you know, and all that stuff. And all I can really tell you is keep running games. Mm-hmm. And also, if you have that super duper glorious, amazing campaign that you want to run, maybe save it and run a 3-shot and then a 6-shot and then a 10-shot. Once you've got that pace, and it's your own pace and it's your player's pace and all that stuff, once you've got that figured out, then then go in and do it. And, you know, go back, listen to Critical Hit, you know, not to toot our own horn, but, you know, figure out when an NPC gets in front of the players and says, you can't do this right now. Not just why in the story is the NPC saying that, but why might I have stopped the characters at that point? Or when an NPC goes, you guys are thinking about this too hard. Here, take this sword and stab that thing. Why did that happen? You know, like, if you go through Critical Hit and think about
progress the plot, way, you bastards.
the way the world interacts with the players and what happens afterwards, you can potentially get a fair amount of insight just at the way that I run my games.
The other thing, take a look at the canned adventures that you've run. See where it says do this, do this, do this. Figure out, you know, similar things. Do the practice ones. Don't do your big glorious magnum opus right away. Do the practice ones like Rodrigo said, and kind of base them off of some of those canned adventures you've done. Your players seem to enjoy that. Able to at least improvise within those.
Well, and in the most basic way, you can just think about it as, you know, how many scenarios do I want to complete before they get to the Lich, right? So if you want 5 scenarios, then come up with 5 things that need to happen or that basically can go on a binary. Like, the players get the big evil axe that tells them how to get to the Lich, or the players destroy the big evil axe. Either one is going to advance them towards that next scenario, right? And then once you're comfortable with that, you can get into basically what I do, which is come up with a ton of scenarios and then let the players kind of like make their way towards the final scenario by jumping to the next scenario that they kind of pick as things are kind of like rushing at their heads.
Yeah. You might want to get a book called Save the Cat. It's a great book on writing for the movies and plot devices and things that you use at certain parts of the film that your hero must get to, and that might help you in at least generating some ideas of structuring your story to get from one point to another. Something to think about.
The same thing. You want to look into resources for writing and the breakdown of those stories and analyze, look at the pre-gen that worked best for you and analyze the breakdown of that story and how it progresses, how it gets your characters from point A to point B. You know, the act structure, if there is one, and you can adapt that or you can reject that as well. You can go, this didn't work as well. Instead, over here, instead of that big red giraffe, I'm going to throw in a blue elephant. It'll work entirely different.
I love this one from Carl. I've been a poor, poor university student for years. I haven't been able to afford or donate anything. But as of 2 months ago, I got my first job as a programmer, and I will begin donating $10 a month when I get my first salary on Monday. It's a small, small price to pay for all the entertainment you've been giving me over the years. That's from Carl. And I don't know where he's from, but yeah.
Carl with a K or Carl with a C?
Carl with a C. And
spells it right.
And he, he's been a member for quite a while. And so thank you, Carl. And congratulations on your job.
Yeah, thanks, Carl.
Yeah.
All right, this one's from Andy. I've been playing in the same gaming group for about 3 years now. We have done different campaigns, but for the most part, the same people. It seems like every time we play, there's always a point in the game where we need to come up with a plan, and it turns into an hour brainstorming session. It becomes this back and forth with the other 4 players throwing out idea after idea, but taking forever to choose one. I throw out an idea and a plan, but just feel the need to act even if it's a bad plan. It's better than the debate. I understand there's an in-game time and out-of-game time, but we only have a limited amount of time each week. For the last 2 sessions, when this back and forth... last 2 sessions when this back and forth happened, I turned out and pulled out my cell phone. That drives me crazy. I feel like I'm getting burnt out on these people and the game. I love D&D and want to play more, but the games are getting tiresome. But I watch the other players. They're like having a lot of fun, and I'm bored with the planning and the rules layering that takes place. Do I just take a break from playing? I live in a small town, so there's not many gaming groups. How do I speed things up and not sound like a dick? I listen to your podcast, and your group figures out the plan, then acts, not an endless back and forth.
yeah, this...
I think
This email sent before the actually, end of the last season.
No, this was actually sent just after we finished up our 5th edition campaign.
Well, then it must be pretty bad, because if he's coming in with the 45 minutes that you guys argued about who got to go and who got to stay, then I can see that. So there's a few things. There's actually a lot of things here. First off, right off the bat, you may be burnt out on your group, and that's okay. And just because you live in a small town doesn't mean that there aren't other gamers in nearby towns. Look around. I mean, it's okay. You're not betraying anybody but by playing with other people.
There's always the interwebs, too.
Yep. You can always do stuff online.
Yeah,
you
know, Roll20 and whatnot.
Roll20, other
doesn't programs John do like that? It. Doesn't John do that? Doesn't he play with a group of people online?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think he plays with his friends from back in Arkansas.
Oh, okay. All right.
There's some and friends, some other fans that of ours that he's met.
I don't know from this if the person that wrote in is the game master.
Didn't sound like it.
So your hands may be tied there. There is not much that you can do to speed it up if the game master just like lets the players discuss things ad infinitum or nauseam, probably more accurately to you. So there might not be much you can do there. What you can do is, at the very least, try to roleplay while this is happening. It's entirely possible that when the kids get to planning, you are like everybody jumps out of character and tries to come up with like the best possible plan. But if you as a player stay in character, and it might not be plausible, but if you stay in character, you might push the other players to stay in character. And some of them might not have characters who would sit down and plan for 3 hours. You know, it's like if one of your friends is playing a very impulsive barbarian, but then when it comes to time out or time to plan, he steps out of character and says like, okay, so here's the 10 possible approaches we have to this. If you stay in character, that might push him to stay in character. And then he'll be like, oh, well, my character wouldn't do this. He'd just charge in.
And you can always talk to your DM about the problem. You know, say, hey, I've noticed this continues to happen. You know, is there anything we can do to speed it up? And or talk to the rest of the group. And you be polite about it. You know, don't be pointing fingers or anything. Just it's like, hey, guys, when we get into a point where we have to make a plan, we spend a lot more time making a plan than I feel is necessary. Would like to actually finish some things at some point.
And yeah, do bring it up. Although it sounds to me, like from what he said, that that's probably going to fall on deaf ears because they enjoy the planning
allows
effort
it to happen.
Of it. And there are groups that do. Like if you've ever played in a Shadowrun game that was firing on all cylinders, you actually spend so much time planning and casing the joint and looking up specs and sending
astrally projecting
into like a nearby region just to make sure that they don't have astral wards that are going to shred your soul, and figuring out what kind of shreds or soul shredding wards they have, like just so much time planning, and then you roll in and you just throw 20 dice rolls. There's a pile of blood, and like you literally just did everything so quickly. And the majority of it was the planning and the stakeout and all the other stuff. So it might just be that this group is not for you, because it might just be that this is what this group enjoys.
Right. And each, I mean, if you have a group of four people, you have six possible two-man, two-person interactions, which means that each person brings something different to the table. If you are happy with every other aspect of gameplay, other than the fact that it seems like it takes forever for people to do whatever we're doing in that planning phase, make sure that you stay engaged. Don't disengage. Don't sit and play on Tumblr. But there may come a point where you sit back, you put in whatever you need to say. This is to do X, Y, Z. They'll talk it over. If that's really the only problem with the group, if nobody's beating on each other, nobody's hateful, the DM's not railroading you, it may be something that you learn to work with because this is a group of your friends. And if not, you have options. You have other gaming options. And I think that the question is this really a deal breaker for you? And if so, how are you going to fix it with this group if you even want to?
Well, and just in group decision making anyway. Like, there's lots of things that you can do just as a part of the group. You can try to force a vote. You can, mm-hmm. you know, and again, try not to be a jerk about it. But, you know, and if it comes to a vote, just, like, figure out which faction has the most votes and just lean on that just so that something happens, just so that there's a majority and you can get going. 12 Angry Man It.
I'm a huge fan of the show, says Harry, and I have a question for you. Mm. It goes like this. I moved into a small town in Michigan last year and DM'd a game of D&D at the new school the year I moved in. Now that school is back in, the previous party and I want to do a new campaign, but one of the kids who played last year was a total blank that none of us like. He wants to play again this year, and I don't want to hurt his feelings by excluding him, but he ruined the campaign last year and treated everyone else as his lackeys. What should I do?
It's a difficult one.
It is a difficult one, and that's too bad for you. I mean, I hate to say it, but that's an interpersonal decision. Not a gaming thing. Like, you have to decide. Sometimes you have to be a jerk to preserve the fun of four other people. Sometimes you might decide that it's worth it to have a slightly crappy game for the sake of not hurting somebody's feelings. It's just like, which of your friends do you invite to coffee and which ones do you ditch? You know,
It's also complicated by the fact that it's a small town.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know what he means by small town in Michigan, but I grew up in a town of 800 people. Mm-hmm. And if you take the high school, which had maybe 100 to 200 kids in it at any one time, the percentage of people that would play D&D was probably relatively small. So if you were the guy that you didn't know which one was the jerk, and then you were not invited back into the cool game, you probably wouldn't have had anyone else to play with. So I understand where Harry's coming from in this issue, if we kick this guy out, he's probably not going to be able to find another group to play with.
Well, and forget that. He's going to know that you just didn't invite him back. So definitely, whatever you decide, be straight about it. Be like, hey, listen, honestly,
maybe what you need to do is find out what are the things that make him the jerk.
Yeah.
And maybe just address those things, saying, hey, man, we had some problems with you.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. Picking your nose. If you could please stop picking your nose, that would help us out tremendously.
Well, that's and I've been on both sides of this one, because my gaming group in college wanted to play a scary, scary Ravenloft adventure. And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I have a tendency to be rather entertaining and funny. And it's really sometimes hard for me to focus on being the scary, scary Dark Avenger of Night. I will, you know, I'll make my references and my jokes. And when they were planning this game, they intentionally excluded me, which is bad, because we all lived in the same building and we all knew each other, and it was clear that they were excluding me. And I said, hey, why are you excluding me? And he said, this is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem. I said, okay, if I play, I will make sure that that is not a problem. We played the game. It was not a problem. When the giggly and jokes started, it wasn't my fault. I may have made it, you know, go a little longer, but it wasn't my fault, because as a player, I knew where my perceived weaknesses were and how to, you know, at least try and address them within that group. So if this guy was unintentionally the jerk, he was a jerk to the point where you don't want to deal with him, and you know, you're not particularly wanting him back in the game, you're going to have to hurt his feelings.
Yep. A break in the game is which you seem to have had, is a good opportunity to assess these things. Mm-hmm. To sit somebody down and say, hey, you are making everybody at the table uncomfortable when you do this. It really sucks when you try to make it so that you know everything, even though I've told you 1,000 times that this is a homebrew campaign. You know, and so on and so forth. It's a good time to address those things, and it's a good time to drop ultimatums and be like, okay, here's the deal. We're gonna go until summer vacation or whatever now. Probably back when you were writing, until spring quarter. And if you don't straighten out, I will have put things in place into the game to eat your character, and he will leave and you will leave, and that'll be that, and we'll shake hands and you'll go play somewhere else unless you straighten up. And I mean, that's legit. And at that moment, that player might be like, well, that sounds like a terrible game, I don't want to play that, and then leave anyway. And that's completely legit as well.
I have a question about a game I am running, says Christopher. I have a big boss, a dragon, but I feel that the way my players are moving through the story, they're going to get to the boss I thought of too fast and be too low level. Do you have any tips about how to handle this situation? Throw in more minions.
Throw more bad guys at them.
What's that?
Throw more bad guys
at them. Dragon, a second guy.
Yeah.
Yes, there's... I mean, definitely. I mean, if you are playing D&D and you're doing level up by killing monsters, which most versions of D&D do, you can do that, and you can have other situations arise that require that the players deal with it, right?
Yeah, so you come to a town full of zombies. That
exactly. There are, you know, it's like, I don't know what the dragon is doing. I don't know if the dragon is intelligent or something, but chances are that the presence of a dragon that's shaking things up and that keeps eating all the paladins and the land is also making it like very easy for necromancers to be walking around and raising corpses, or for your mind flayers to go try to build themselves a little kingdom over there by controlling people's brains and or eating them. Yeah. So that kind of creates something, and you can do something like, oh, this looks like a place where somebody might know something about the dragon, and it turns out to be something else.
Yeah. Yeah, that dragon that's over there, and they really mean gnolls.
I suppose that's one way to go
about it. Basilisk?
Basilisk, there you go.
You know, dragons, they're like little and they've got claws and you boil them and then you eat them. Like, I don't think that's a dragon.
Dragons. We got a whole infestation of them over there at the abandoned missionary.
Yeah, red dragon.
Don't we see lobsters anymore?
Yeah, exactly.
Chris writes in, I was just wanting to ask for some clarification on Rodrigo's stealth house rules that are posted on your website. As I understand it, a player is able to make a stealth check at any point as part of a move action and does not require any cover or concealment. So effectively, they can hide in plain sight, and the only penalty is the person trying to hit the stealth character gets a +5 to their awareness. Is this correct?
I believe so, yes.
I currently have a player, a thief, who is a +19 to stealth and a level 4, and already he's pretty much hidden all the time from any monsters in the encounter. I understand this is what his class is built to do, but sometimes it's just hard to justify why he's able to be hidden while standing clearly in the middle of the room. I also want to ask about invisible characters. You say that a creature cannot hit an enemy they do not have the awareness score to hit, but how does this work for invisible characters who do not have a stealth value to compare to awareness?
Oh, I actually went into it because invisibility just gives you... God, what is it called? Hang on.
Concealment.
Yeah, it just gives you concealment. So they're still at a -5 to hit them. Then if they're stealthed, then on top of the invisibility, they have concealment, so they don't get the their likelihood to be spotted isn't as high. Now, as far as justifying it, those rules I specifically wrote so that your rogues can do crap like that, so that they can be in the center of the room and just kind of like duck down and not draw attention to themselves or whatever. Yeah. You can still rule that is like, well, there would be no way for you to not be spotted here. The other thing is that the moment that any sort of area of attack comes up, or the moment that they break that stealth, they are once again visible. So you got that. Because you always kind of know the general area where they are.
What level did you say they were?
19, and his, I already closed the email, sorry, but his rogue was level 19, plus something else, +4 something else to his stealth or something.
Oh, no, it was rolling a +19 to the stealth. Right.
At a level 4 character.
Is that what he said?
That's, I don't think so. Like, it was a ridiculously high stealth
already.
And a super low level. Let's
see if I can find it again.
Yeah, find it again, because I didn't catch that part of it.
I think it was this one right here. All right. I have a player, a thief, who is a +19 to stealth and level 4 and already is pretty much hidden from all the monsters in the that they encounter.
5, 6, 7 plus a level 20 to dex would be another 5, so that's 12. That's a +7 from somewhere
insane.
Insane.
Yeah.
Skill focus would be +3.
item bonuses or.
Yeah, I mean, he could do it.
Maybe he's got one of them.
He can do it.
Sauron rings.
If you do got any, you know, sort of magic, then yeah, that's kind of your justification right there for.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a good point. If your guy has a cloak of elven kind or some stealthy shoes or something like that, that gives him a big stealth bonus, then yeah, that's actually a good justification.
Mm-hmm.
But also, perhaps in the future, don't let your players go all in into a single skill because it can actually be problematic.
Yeah.
But again, if you have a player who has a regular plus 19 to stealth, it's actually then not unreasonable to do one of the following things. Throw a monster again against them who has a plus 19 to awareness. Then they'll be evenly matched and it'll just come down to the dice rolls. Throw a monster that has Tremor Sense, because Tremor Sense basically gets around stealth, period.
Anything that steps.
I mean, and again, don't do it every time.
Right.
Because they're just getting their normal rogue, like, hyper damage bonus, but you want that in a rogue.
Sometimes they're walking through a kitchen and there's flour all over the floor.
No, the rules get around that, too.
Oh, doesn't? Boo.
Yep.
Anyway, here goes Joseph, who says, at the beginning and end of each campaign I run, I usually let my players describe where they have gone and what they've been up to. Though it hasn't been a problem yet, my players are very creative and have big plans for their characters, and often will come up with whole villages and new NPCs. How much should I actually let them influence the world in this way? I don't like to restrict their actions, but I'm also afraid of a possible god complex. Any advice is greatly appreciated.
Bring in as much as you're comfortable.
Yeah.
I sometimes have to basically beat up my players to get any sort of like, what did your character do on your summer vacation kind of thing.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So if your players are just handing you NPCs and villages and all this stuff, again, always tell them that you have the ability to veto it, but I would turn around and set the game there. Like, just go take them on a tour of all the places that they've already been to. It like creates this like amazing automatic buy-in from the players. Like, you will just be doing stuff that they're already totally into. That's kind of what you want out of your game.
Yeah, and that's a good way to show, you know, how things are changing in your campaign world. If you go back to a place where they created and describe what's different and
just make sure that they understand that the moment they tell you about it,
it's
in your
now.
Hands.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had that before where I actually, during Lords of the Feywild, I remember I was talking to Steven, and we had been talking about Orym's parents or whatever, and he was like, well, I think his mom would do something like this, and I'd be like, well, it's too late. That character's in the mix. Now I get to decide what Orym's mom is like. And you just have to be clear about that with the players.
Right.
And you'll probably get two reactions. Some of the players will be like, great. Yep, I hope that it's actually on fire and I get to kill whoever did it. Or they'll be like, oh, well, maybe I don't want to make up this stuff. I'll just make up some other stuff. And that's fine, you know, because sometimes the emotional investment that players have in the game, sometimes you actually kind of have to protect that. There are certain things, depending on the player, that you have to protect.
And, so, you know, you could always, make some sort of arrangements. Say, okay, yeah, if you want this to be your own little protected kingdom, fine. But
Sure. It's like, I mean, I'm going to do something, like, try to do something with it, even if it is like, oh, no, like, a dragon doesn't burn it down. It's like, might be a good place for a home base for your, or a base as your characters are moving through the landscape to get to.
I think this mailbag episode should be called Too Many Christophers, because it seems like either the same Christopher has written in, I'm not really paying attention to the last name, or there's a lot of Christophers out there who are interested. I have listened to you guys talk a lot about other versions and settings of D&D, and was surprised I've never heard anything about Death Watch. I used to game with a group, and we played just about everything, and Death Watch was one that I liked that died quick with the group. What do you guys think about Death Watch?
Not familiar.
The only Death Watch that I'm familiar with was Continuity Comics 1997 crossover. It was terrible.
Yeah, I got nothing.
Yeah, I'm just not familiar with it. Sorry.
Okay. Critical hit question. How do you determine the severity of failure with a skill challenge? And is a failed skill challenge as significant as a failed combat? Further, how do you reward experience in the case? That comes from Daniel.
Okay. Give them to me one at a time.
How do you determine the severity of failures within a skills challenge?
Basically, where I want to go with the story.
And is a failed skill challenge as significant as a failed combat?
Yes.
How do you reward experience in these cases?
Same way. Basically, a level 16 combat versus a level 16 skill challenge, they get the same amount of XP.
Okay, that should answer that question.
All right.
Eric says, I apologize if this is long. Here's the problem. I talked my older sister into playing in a solo Star Wars Saga Edition, a game that we both love Star Wars, and the system is fairly familiar to me. She's expressed that she is not very keen on combat, and she's not very combative in nature, which is fine, as combat can be more decisive than that. Other than the use of a skills challenge or a special social encounter in general roleplay, how do I move the game forward while removing all of the most, all but the most necessary of combat? Thank you for the hours of fun, Eric. So, you know, that's an interesting question, and it's one that I think is worth bringing up, is does every encounter have to turn into a battle? Do you just run into the room and start killing everything there, or are there other ways around it? I know people don't like me talking about World of Warcraft, mm-hmm. but there was one player who took a very passive approach to playing World of Warcraft, where he leveled up not by going out and killing everything. He passively grew his character, and I think at through the time, I think he was up to level 60 through all just his skills and work and doing minimal killing, like if he had to go and kill something to eat or to build some armor. That's the way it was, but it wasn't running into the house and killing all the goblins and trolls and things that are in there.
Well, there's two issues there. One of them is, what are the game's themes?
Right. Yeah.
So that is very much going against the grain of a World of Warcraft.
Oh, yeah, very much so, yes.
And you don't necessarily want that in a game.
No.
Now, it sounds to me like this person, I will call him Christopher for short, is happy to tailor the themes of the game to her predilections.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he already hit on a lot of stuff there. You know, skill challenges and kind of social stuff is big. If you have a lot of kind of like mystery type situations, that the excitement of interrogating people and figuring out who did what and why everybody's hiding something can be very exciting without combat. And then, like, the moment that you finally corner the culprit and he's like, aha, pulls out a blaster, then you don't even have to like go into combat. Even you can just say like, well, he's surrounded and he surrenders, or you shoot him.
Right, right.
Or he shoots you and he gets away. You know, and the excitement of it is actually the build up towards that.
Question: mechanics. Free actions can be used while it's not your turn, but how do you fit it in? Immediate interruption reactions spell this out nicely, but I can't find rules for free actions. I know that typical free actions don't really matter from a timing perspective, but I've found a couple of instances where they can make a difference. For example, the Scion can use forceful push as a free action to slide a creature. Can I use that to interrupt a charge? How would you rule it?
So this is two separate things. A free action has the potential to be used at any point. But only free actions that specifically say that they can be used during other moments in the fight can be used outside of your turn. So the free action exists as a way to for it to not be an opportunity action or an immediate action.
Right.
And in fact, there are still... Well, yeah. I mean, while being used outside of...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But so outside of the turn, so that it's neither an opportunity or an immediate within your turn, so that you don't have to spend your move minor or
standard
on it. There are also actions that are no action, which is something to even get around the problems of using a free action. So usually, yes. If you're... power doesn't say you can do this in response to something else as a free action, then you can't.
Role-playing question. Go ahead, Rob.
There's also, double-checking the free action rules, a creature can take a free action to use an attack power only once per turn. So if an attack grants you a free action, you can only use it once per turn. Much like, I guess this would be the same with opportunity attacks are technically free actions.
Well, they're opportunity actions.
Opportunity actions, similar thing. Creatures don't normally have attack powers that can be used as free actions, but some powers and other effects grant the ability to use an attack power, usually a basic attack, as a free action. For instance, a character might have two different abilities that let him or her make a melee basic attack as a free action when their respective triggers occur. If both abilities are triggered on the same turn, the character can make only one of the melee basic attacks during that turn.
Good to know. So yeah, that's usually why you are allowed to use free actions outside of your turn. Is so that your warlord can be like, hey, you stab it. Or so that if you have a trigger, you can then use it.
Mm-hmm. This limitation does not apply to free actions that a creature is forced to take by an enemy.
There you go.
Role-playing question. Whenever I make a character, I find I focus too much on the mechanics and end up creating a character that's too min-maxed. Mm-hmm. I feel like my character's personality falls by the wayside. How would you suggest creating a character who has more personality than damage output per round?
Start with a personality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Decide what your character's personality is going to be first, then make mm-hmm. the character.
Yeah, what do they act like? What do they like? What do they hate?
Yeah. What do they eat?
Do they talk funny?
Yep. Pick powers and feats and skills and whatnot that are built into that idea.
Where do they stand on major dragon based issues?
Anti dragon.
There you go. That's something.
Pro dungeon. Yep.
Pro dungeon anti dragon. All right, this is a rather long question, so I'll just go into it. I'm part of a D&D group, says Daniel, and we take it in turns to run the game. It's currently my turn to run, and I'm trying to go for a more serious game as opposed to the last guy's silly off-the-wall campaign. But they don't seem to want to take it seriously. They tell me off for overacting my characters, and the last two DMs both killed off my PCs. I am the third DM. The first DM did wacky stuff to all of our characters, but mine was the only one with no advantages. He cuts off my... Oh, I won't go into that. And it seemed like my character was the butt of all their jokes. The second DM was better, but the players ruined it by taking the piss out of my character and eventually just ignoring the main quest line completely to go to the desert and buy slaves. This killed my character because I was the only one who tried to save the world. As the third DM, I don't feel like I'm having fun. One person has left the group because we conflict too much, but I feel like I'm rambling. The players are distracted. I've put the story on hiatus for my A-levels, but I don't know if I want to take it off of it. My question is simply, what do I do? I don't want to leave because they're pretty much the only friends I have, and I want to keep up with them. Do I just end the game? I've tried talking to them with mixed results, and they all said they would take it more seriously, but most of them haven't stuck to it.
It sounds like you're not having fun.
Yeah.
Stop playing.
Yeah, you might not want to run for these guys, and when you play, you might want to just get in on the goofiness. I mean, I understand that. I very much understand being the odd man out in a group where you want to kind of bring a super duper role play character, and the game master and the other players literally just don't give you any time to do it. It's like from the moment the game starts to when it ends, it's just a sequence of dice rolls, right? And it's the other way around for a lot of people where they're like, oh man, I got all these stats and this synergizes with this, and then there isn't a single combat, and then by the end of the fight they're like, but we didn't fight anything, you guys. It's the same thing with tone, where you are like, my character is a dragon slayer and I came up with like his entire backstory and his dad's entire backstory and his grandpa's entire backstory, and everybody is like, my character is Butch the Barbarian, and that's just what they call him. He's actually just a really fat rogue, you know. It's like, and everybody's like, that's great, and you're like, but my grandpa, like, I came up with my grandpa, you guys, and nobody cares. So you either have to stop playing with these guys or just get in on it, just throw it out the window and just be like, okay, when I'm playing with these guys, it has to be wacky. And definitely don't run the type of game that you like to run for them, because they're not going to like it.
Yeah. I would say that if you're worried about coming back to this game, don't. Either come back to a different game or walk away from the table and do other things with your friends. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not... The role-playing games are not the only thing that you guys can do to interact with each other and still be pals.
Absolutely.
And that is a huge, huge thing that I ran into a lot in college was we gamed and we gamed and we gamed and we gamed. And when we finally had to do things that were not games, we actually went out and became people. And I'm not saying that you're not one, and I'm not saying that you can't be one. I'm saying that other interests are always cool. It's always a good idea. Try bowling. I got class credit for bowling. At
one point, so. Yeah, too bad universities don't do that anymore. That's such a shame. They don't. A lot of universities now do not have physical education as a requirement, or the physical education they do have is like dietary and managing your time,
personal wellness.
Yeah. And it's like, what? We had to take 4 hours of physical education, and it was wonderful.
I mean, I don't
totally
know.
Bowling.
I took bowling, fencing, golf, and what was the last one?
Pool.
No, I didn't do
badminton.
Yeah, it was Batman. Yeah, no, it was racquetball.
Badminton.
Badminton.
It was racquetball. That's what I took.
I'm sorry, English is not my first language.
No, that's okay. Joshua says, when an NPC... Oh, this is specifically for Rodrigo. When an NPC is fighting alongside the party, you seem to avoid saying what they're hitting for and how much damage they're doing. I think that knowing this information would help the party figure out how tough the monsters actually are, at least in some cases. Why do you not tell the players?
Oh, because it would help them figure out how tough the monsters are in some cases.
Yeah, exactly.
For exactly the reason you said.
That's not necessarily information I want the party to have. So that, and it is a fun mini game for Rob and Steven to play. How tough is this monster?
Rodrigo sees there me taking notes where I'll hit on what it hits on. And then you'll see me put a range in between of what that hit is until eventually I work it down to the thing. So whether
I'm making the same mental scribbles.
Yeah, whether Rodrigo is telling us or not, it is a fun mini game for us to figure that out.
And I'm perfectly fine with you doing that because it encourages you guys to pay attention during other people's turns, which I want. So it's fine. Not that you wouldn't necessarily, but it's like, that's perfect. Which actually, now that we're going to Roll20, is probably going to go away to a certain degree, unless I'm like always putting in the command to hide my rolls, which I don't necessarily want to do. So you'll at least know what the monsters are hitting for.
That's all right.
You could actually already do, because since I roll out in the open, Rob usually figures out the bonuses anyway. So.
Yep.
Adam writes and says, I'm wondering if you guys are going to do a level up episode for leveling up to 16. Rodrigo, would you like to take this one?
Yes, we did one for Aurum. You can listen to it if you are a VIP for Major Spoilers.
Yep. Put your browser to members.majorspoilers.com. Sign up. I think it's bronze level and above. So $2 a month and higher gets you access to that and the character sheets and all that stuff.
Yep. Okay. So we are not recording one for anybody else because who's coming back? Who knows?
Well, and the other thing too is... they're very, very long in what we did for this level up. It is the raw recording that I have before editing was over 3 hours.
Yep. I will say, from the very beginning, just me going like, I'm going to encourage Steven to play a ranger or a rogue. I want to be a wizard. I'm like, great. And to this day, we're still dealing with it. Thus, like the extra hour and a half that it took
to pick the
secondary tier of encounter and
daily powers.
Yeah. Daily and utility powers, and also all of his rituals.
Yep.
So.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I know the ritual pain.
Yep.
All right. We've only got a few more questions here. Oh,
but dailies are easy.
There's going to be like a double-sized Q&A.
Yep.
Heck yeah.
Oh, my question.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
True.
Who were Grin and Rallara? They seem to have appeared out of nowhere and fade back into nothing. I don't remember hearing about them before, but the guys talked about them like they were familiar. Was this intentional timey-wimey confusion, or did I miss something?
Intentional timey-wimey confusion.
Oh, those guys.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, who are Grin and Rallara? I don't... Oh...
Yes.
Yep. That was for those of you who are confused by that confusion, that's the Dragonborn that Rob played during Celestial Crusade and the random Elf Ranger that showed up. Yes, that was because of Penelope's chronometer screwing with how long it took to do any given person's timeline.
Right.
It was Rob's sixth character?
Probably.
Joey writes in, I'm emailing you because you have produced an excellent library of wonderful adventures.
Awesome.
I have a question and another thing. First, by what mechanic does Ket allow the social skill rerolls with Beguiling Tongue? The version I have found in the PHB 1 only gives you a plus 5 to your roll.
Is it Beguiling Tongue?
Just
that does
a moment.
That? I don't think it's Beguiling Tongue.
It's not Beguiling Tongue. It's the other. I've got two utility powers that are based on that
build.
Yeah, and that I want to say that's
actually
a skill
power. Beguiling Tongue just gives me the bonus. I think you were correct. It is Empathic Read, a insight-based skill power from the Player's Handbook 3 for level 6. And the trigger is an ally fails a bluff, diplomacy, or intimidate, and the target rerolls that ally is the target rerolls the skill check and uses either result.
Yep. So if you heard us call out Beguiling Tongue and do that, that was just us making a mistake in which power it was. It's actually Empathic Read.
The rest are just some suggestions on some epic destinies that we should take.
Well, save it.
Yeah, so there you go. That is the last question.
I'm open to suggestions.
Yeah. Well,
I have suggestions for you guys. I just didn't want to hit you with them yet, but it's going to be...
Not too long.
Dear Spoiler Right.
About five levels.
How's about some letters that say, hey, question for Matthew?
It does say, for Torque, you can, in fact, be over 7 feet tall with the Martial Powers Eternal Defender. It increases both your height by 25% and your weapon's die roll, 1d12, to 2d6.
Whoa.
That would have been good to know.
That would have been useful.
Which I knew about, though.
All right, everybody, that wraps it up for this installment of Critical Hit. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. Thank you so much to everyone who's a Major Spoilers VIP. Honestly, I know some people get tired of me talking about the VIPs, but really, without your support, we wouldn't have been doing this show for, what, 10 years now?
10 years.
That we've been doing it.
300
it's been like,
six,
it's been like
seven, what episode
seven or eight.
Are we on?
Yeah.
We are getting close to 400. So divide by 50.
Almost 8 years?
8 years, yeah.
Dang.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything for eight. Well, I guess I've been married.
That counts for something.
Gaming with you guys actually is like having five wives. So,
yeah. Who is excited about the next season?
Definitely excited.
Terrified. Utterly terrified.
I'm
kind of
scared, too.
Yeah, I think that's the correct answer. That's a correct question to ask is who's terrified about the next season?
I kind of am, but I'm kind of not.
Can I not be both?
Oh, absolutely.
You can't be both. One or the other.
No. You can be excited and terrified.
It's like being on top of the roller coaster right before it goes. Yes. You know, it's going up and you know that the drop
perfect
is
analogy.
Coming. You know the drop is coming and you know the drop is terrifying.
That's great because that's what I'm going for. Is like I've been getting,
that's the theme for the next season, roller coasters.
I've been getting everybody.
Oh, so we're going to be playing the cartoon.
Yeah.
I've been getting everybody like plenty of information about all this stuff that may or may not happen. So the game's gonna start, and yeah, everybody's gonna like start tipping over the abyss.
Yes. Yes.
Roller coaster of love.
All right, everybody, and here it comes. Be ready for it.
Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
This podcast is copyright 2015 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.